Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In the United States, we raise our children to expect to work hard to achieve their goals. But as a country of dreamers, we also encourage them to imagine loving what they do. We want them not only to earn wages for their labor, but to find meaning. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The latest collection of StoryCorps interviews edited for broadcast on public radio stations around the country features people who love what they do. From saving lives to growing food to keeping the trains running on time, some of the most fortunate people in our society are those who believe they were put on this earth to do their jobs. Dave Isay is founder of StoryCorps. His new book, drawn from StoryCorps submissions, is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town for an Arts and Letters Live event that I'll be hosting tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here. That's a lot of Dave for one day. You coming now and tonight.
I have the Dave bonus. You and I have spoken a number of times, but honestly, like millions of listeners, I cannot get enough of StoryCorps.
Oh.
Did you understand at the outset of this project how enduring it would be? Did you think you would be doing this so many years later?
No. Well, when StoryCorps started, I actually haven't thought about this in a long time. It was supposed to be a limited time project, so we would have been finished by now. I think we thought about it as a 10-year thing when we launched. And, you know, it was an experiment. I mean, you know, StoryCorps, we opened 12 and a half years ago in Grand Central Terminal, and you bring a grandparent or a friend, anyone you want to honor by listening to their story. And you're in this booth with a loved one and a trained facilitator whose job is kind of to bear witness to the interview, and they keep a log of everything that happens. And you have this very intense conversation where it's kind of, people think of it as, if I had, you know, 40 minutes left to live, what would I say to and ask of this person who means so much to me? And then at the end, you get a copy and another goes to the Library of Congress so your great-great-grandkids can get to know your grandfather, whoever it is you brought through his voice and story. And now about 250,000 Americans have participated now. So when it started, I had all kinds of fears of, you know, Jerry Springer kind of crazy stuff happening and people killing each other in the booth. Like, I just didn't, because it was an experiment.
What if they get in a big fight talking about these intimate details?
Or they try and like, I just didn't know. Or maybe people would like abuse it and use it as a recording studio. And, you know, we've had we have an app now, and we also have the booth. And in the booths themselves, we've had about 70,000 interviews, about 140,000 people. And it's a tribute to the facilitators and I think to the, you know, to who we are as people, that not one of those interviews has gone wrong. Every single pair of people have treated it with respect, which is one of the many miracles of the booth.
People wanting to go in there with somebody they care about and share stories or get that person's story, that's one thing. But the rest of us are supposed to only care about celebrities, right? I mean, that's the picture that many people have
kind of
American culture.
Yes.
You know, but this proves it's not true.
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to make public radio documentaries and then like ended up creating StoryCorps. And, you know, these are just the stories that are interesting to me. I couldn't care less about most celebrity stories, although they're people. But, you know, I think that these are there are stories hidden in plain sight all around us. And, you know, StoryCorps is about the poetry and the grace and the wisdom that's everywhere if we just take the time to listen. And those are the stories that really matter. And those are, you know, that's what makes you want to get up in the morning, you know, and reminds you what we're doing here on this earth.
So previously you've pulled StoryCorps submissions into collections about love stories and gratitude and mothers. One might think that a collection of stories about people doing their jobs would somehow be less emotionally captivating. But what we hear in these stories are examples of how often people's identities are tied up in their work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this book in so many ways is a love letter to people who don't usually get thanked for their jobs. And it's teachers and social workers and nurses and, you know, and their jobs mean a lot to them. I mean, it's in many of these stories, it's, you know, it's hit them like lightning, and it's what they feel they're meant to do. And again, you know, it also, I think, is kind of a shake on the shoulder when you read these things or listen to them about what it means to have a job that you really care about and that you were born to do.
Can you tell us about Barbara Abelhauser? Because I don't think anybody thinks they were born to do her job.
Sure. So Barb Abelhauser, and I was at a reading in Austin last night, and someone knew Barb Abelhauser, so it's such a small world. Hmm. She worked in an office job for many years and hated it. And all she ever wanted to do was be a bridge tender. And eventually one day had the courage to quit her job and started working on the Ortega River drawbridge in Jacksonville, Florida, basically sitting in a closet-sized room for her entire workday every week for years and years and years. And she came to StoryCorps with a friend to talk about that work.
The pay's horrible. The benefits are worse. But I have the most gorgeous view in the entire city. I mean, executives who make hundreds of thousands of dollars do not have my view. And I'm getting paid to stop and look. That's the thing I think I love the most about this.
You must see a lot of things that the rest of us miss.
You know, I think about that a lot because I've been sitting in the same exact spot for all these years. And I see the passage of the seasons. I see the alligator that hangs out below my window. And when she lays her eggs, I hear baby gators barking. And people don't even realize we're there. They'll walk past us and say the most intimate, private things, and we hear them. People go on dates on these bridges, and they propose. So you get this little tiny snapshot of people's personal lives that they don't even realize that they're giving you. There was a fisherman that used to come through the bridge every morning like clockwork. I never knew his name. You know, we had a connection, but we don't really know who each other is. And one day he came through. I waved. And I found out in the news that maybe 10 minutes later, while he was on his boat heading out to fish, he had a heart attack and passed away. His boat washed up on the shore of the river. He was on the boat alone. So I was the last person that saw him alive. Makes you think, makes you appreciate. You know, I'll be out there at 3 in the morning. There's no traffic. It's quiet. And I'll look up and there's the moon. And I try to thank the universe at least once a night for this opportunity, you know. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. And if that happens, I want to have woken up that day and not thought, I don't want to go to work, you know. Most people don't have that. I love it.
So that recording of Barb Abelhauser was made in 2009. And since then, she's moved away from Jacksonville.
Yeah, so I was the person who, at the reading in Austin yesterday, she lives in, I think, Seattle or somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, and she's working as a bridge tender there.
Okay, so she just changed her amazing view.
Yes, changed her view. That's exactly right.
You know, I was thinking about this collection because one of the things that I love thinking about is how the world works because people have different drives, right? If everybody wanted to be a heart surgeon or everybody wanted to be a farmer or everybody wanted to be an artist, it wouldn't work.
Right.
And the different things that consume us are what have allowed the human race to kind of prosper.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah, I mean, I think of there's a story in the book. And you know, that story as well, I mean, that is just so poetic when you read it on the page. There's a guy who grew up in Wyoming, son of a coal miner. He had tons of brothers and sisters. His dad died in the coal mines, and his mom brought him up as a single mom. And the first time he went to the dentist, he decided this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, you know, and he was just totally convinced. And none of the kids, like going to college was not something that was part of this family's kind of existence. But he said, I'm doing it. And in the interview, I don't know, he's 80 years old. And he says, I still have the same passion every day to get up and do this dentistry that that I did, you know, 50 years ago when he went to the dental schools and said, you know, you can let me in or not let me in, but I'm going to be a dentist, you know. Everybody, you know, it's interesting. Different people have these totally, totally different callings. But I think inside of all of us, you know, one of the lessons from this book is like kind of a still voice that knows what the answer is and what it is that we're kind of meant to contribute to this world.
Hmm. I have to imagine that this collection is really inspirational to people who don't love their work right now, who are thinking, well, I'll just get through the workday and get through the work life. You know, you hear about people who are so really inspired by their work that it's hard not to want that for yourself if you don't have it.
Well, there's a quote we put at the front of the book, which is this famous Mary Oliver line from a poem where she says, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Which is kind of, you know, which, you know, resonates through all of the pieces in this book. I mean, you have people who are sanitation workers, you know, who feel like that's their calling. You know, I think, you know, one of the lessons of this book and of StoryCorps is that if attention must be paid. And if it's really not working and you're really miserable, a lot of people make tremendous sacrifices to do the work that they feel like they're meant to do. None of them have any regrets making that change.
Do you think we've gotten off course in this country? Because when we talk about educating the workforce, we're really just talking about the paycheck, right? We're not necessarily encouraging kids to follow their passions anymore. We're encouraging them to find a job that means that they won't have to live in our basements for the foreseeable future.
Well, you know, I think that the messages to kids are questionable. And I, you know, again, I think what StoryCorps is in many ways is collecting the wisdom of humanity. And you got to listen. You know, you got to listen when you've got these, you know, this largest collection of human voices telling us answers. And you know, there's definitely a message out there to our kids, millennials, that you want to, you know, the Silicon Valley dream, that you work as you make as much money as you possibly can as fast as you can, and then you retire, and that's the dream. And the stories in this book tell of a very different dream, which is, you know, feeling really passionate about your work, working unbelievably hard, and finding meaning in your work. So, yeah, I mean, I think that it's a no regrets kind of thing. You know, as I said before, everybody in this book who does something where they feel like, you know, either it's hit them like lightning and they know this is what they're meant to do, or in other cases, it's kind of a combination of people who are doing something they're very, very good at. They're treated with dignity and they feel like they're doing something for their family or for the world. You know, that there is a great deal of joy and just of completion in their work life.
Participating in the culling and the editing of so many of these over the years, what have you learned about the person on the other side, the person who is doing the listening? Is there a certain quality of listening that evokes the best conversations?
Well, I thought when, you know, I made public radio documentaries for decades before starting StoryCorps. And I thought that there was something magic about me, like that's why the interviews were so great, because I was like so phenomenal. And then, like, from the first day in StoryCorps, I realized like it had absolutely nothing to do with me, that these, you know, everybody's capable of doing these interviews. And I think what happens in, you know, StoryCorps is designed to kind of take traditional documentary and turn it on its head and say that the final product doesn't matter. It's the act of listening. And everybody is capable of doing this, you know, and it's all about generosity. StoryCorps is kind of the opposite of reality TV. No one comes to get rich. No one comes to get famous. It's just this act of generosity and love. And, you know, we launched this app a little more than a year ago, where you can do StoryCorps anytime, any place, and with one tap upload it to the Library of Congress. And we saw from the first days, I, again, was worried about whether people were going to, you know, kind of treat it with respect. And I'm a little bit wary of, you know, how cell phones and people who had never heard of public radio, who had never heard of StoryCorps, could pick it up and do those interviews like pros, you know. So it's all in us. It's just about listening and being generous with other people.
Dave Isay is here. He's founder of StoryCorps, and his new book is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town for an Arts and Letters live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. He has a new book out called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town for an Arts and Letters live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. What have you learned, Dave, about the way people respond to these based on how they share them? Because it's really easy now to take a StoryCorps piece and let it go viral.
What we broadcast is I just saw this figure last week for the first time. It's 0.04% of what's actually recorded, and we see every interview as equally valuable and hopefully an important, sometimes a sacred moment in people's lives. But some of these interviews have this have this quality that's universal that make them appropriate to share with a larger audience. And that's, you know, what we're trying to do with StoryCorps, and we have a very long way to go, is to, really take the ethos of StoryCorps, which is not so different from the ethos of public radio, and, you know, make it part of the, you know, woven into the fabric of this country. So it's about listening and recognizing, you know, the value in everybody's story and everybody's life. We take these pieces that are, when something happens on the air, you know, you can, that's remarkable. You can almost see like the sparks coming out of someone's mouth, you know, and those are the moments that we put out. And what I hope happens is when you hear one of these stories on the radio or you read them in the book, and it's a very different experience. We don't transcribe radio stories. We go back to the original transcripts and edit them for poetry on the page. But that, you know, that you'll recognize a little bit of yourself in someone who you might have thought was much different than you. And in doing that, kind of build, you know, realize that maybe we're not as different as one might think from everything going on in politics and all that kind of craziness. Yeah.
It seems to me that sometimes personal accounts can give us a different way into stories that we feel like we've already experienced. Certainly the pain of 9/11 is one of those. John and Jane Vigiano were exceptionally generous in sharing their stories about their memories of that day, on which their losses were almost inconceivably large.
Right. So we have these big special initiatives for StoryCorps where we'll interview many people around a subject or a group. And our first one was with 9/11 families. So everyone who lost a loved one on September 11th comes to leave a record of their lives. And John Vigiano, who's a retired firefighter, son of a firefighter, one of his kids was a firefighter, one of his kids was a police officer, and they both perished on 9/11. And he came in with his wife to remember them.
There were a couple of days each year you were allowed to take your children to work, and Joe loved it. That was his birthday present, that he would come and spend the night in the firehouse. We'd have a cake, and the guys I work with, they would take a milk container, and they'd cut out the facsimile of a building, and they'd put it on the top of the cake, and then they would light it up. And they would tell Joe to put it out, and he would throw a pot of water on it. The birthday cake was a little soggy, but this is what he wanted. Joe started dating a young lady whose father was a police officer. And he come home one day and he says, "I'm taking a police test." I says, "Joe, you're only 17 years old." He says, "No big deal." He passed the test. And when he graduated, they assigned him to East New York, where I started my career. On the other side of the room, my son, John, wanted nothing to do with police or emergency service or fire department. He wanted to be the next Donald Trump. He was going to make $1 million and take care of his mother and father. But in 1984, I came down with throat cancer. He noticed then how my unit took care of us. And he says, "I'm going to become a fireman." I says, "You're kidding me. Firemen don't make millions of dollars. How am I going to live like a king?" But I was very happy, very proud. My father had been on the fire department. And he was the first one to be issued badge number 3436. And when John decided he wanted to be a firefighter, they reissued it to my son John. So the badge was only used by two. Both the boys would call me when they were working. John would always call around 3:30, 4 o'clock. And that particular night, September 10th, we spoke for a few minutes. And I says, "I love you." And he says, "I love you." Joe called me in the morning and told me to turn on the television that a plane just hit the Trade Center. He says, I'm heading south on West Street. This is a big one. And I just said, be careful. I love you. He said, I love you too. That was it. We had the boys for John for 36 years, Joe for 34 years, ironically. Badge number 3436. I don't have any could've, should've, or would've's. I wouldn't have changed anything. There's not many people that the last words they said to their son or daughter was, I love you. And the last words they heard was, I love you. So that makes me sleep at night.
It can't have been easy for him to go in there and record that, but there's so much love and so much pride. I'm breaking up here, but these are hard to hear, and yet they really do feel like you're connected to real people in a way that, you know, video from a distance could never do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm not sure that video couldn't do it, but I do think that that because this is, you know, so much of what we see in media is like people, like if you watch 24-hour news, you're like taking something from the people that you're mm-hmm. interviewing. And the Hippocratic oath of StoryCorps is that when you come into the booth, you're getting something. We find that with, firefighters, first responders, we now have a project with post-9/11 vets and their families, that a lot of people come to StoryCorps who have never talked about the day before, who won't go to a therapist. But because this goes to the Library of Congress, it feels like it's not self-indulgent to come in, and they'll come in and have this conversation for history. It's kind of one of the miracles of StoryCorps. And they all, you know, we'll never do something where it's going to re-traumatize people. But, you know, I know that we actually did an animation of this also. Mr. Vigiano wants people to remember his kids. And I know that it's something that he has a great deal of pride in. And I also think that, you know, listening to that, StoryCorps is, you know, as I said, collecting the wisdom of humanity and that wisdom of, you know, saying I love you to your kids. I mean, when you hear that, once you hear that, you're going to say I love you to your kids every time you say goodbye to them. I mean, it's and again, these are the important lessons for all of us. And there are so many distractions. And what I hope that StoryCorps does is help people, you know, remember, you know, what's really important, which is, you know, our families, being kind to each other, being loving to each other, being decent and, you know, living lives of purpose.
Talk about those animations. You've been doing those for a while now.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be showing some of them tonight.
Did everybody on the team think instantly this is a great idea? Or were there people who said, are you kidding me?
So I've had people have been asking me to put cameras in the booth since the beginning of StoryCorps. Mm-hmm. And we'll never do that because it would detract from the experience. It's just two people, two microphones like this, looking in each other's eyes and having this conversation and kind of forgetting that the rest of the world is out there. We live in a visual age. And I knew that in order for StoryCorps to eventually, and we have not gotten there, have the impact that we hope it's going to have someday, that we had to add visuals to these things. But I didn't really know how. So one day, a facilitator, who are these, you know, people who travel around and record the stories, came into my office and said, you know, I'm a facilitator by day, but I'm an animator by night. And my brother, who teaches swimming at the Y, is a animator by night, and we've started animating StoryCorps stories. And I just thought it was ridiculous, and I tried to throw him out of my office. But back then, we used to have DVDs in our computers, and he slammed one into my computer, and one of these things showed up. And I saw that they had figured out how to take these stories and, you know, not only not subtract from the power of them, but add to the power with these animations. So we've done many, you know, a bunch of animations. You can find them all on the web, and we'll play some tonight.
There are all kinds of occupations that one associates with working outside in public spaces and on the street. Until I learned about Hermann Hein, I had never put astronomy in that category.
Yeah, I met one of the great things about being on book tour is meeting people from the book. And I met Hermann last week, and he's quite a character. He's from Baltimore, and in Fells Point, which is a neighborhood in Baltimore. He stands with a telescope outside. He's 85 years old now, and he's a street corner astronomer. And each night, He gives people the chance to look at the stars through his telescope. And he came to StoryCorps with his nephew, John.
Uncle Herman, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a scientist, but I have certain kinds of learning disabilities. My mother used to say, you can spell Andromeda, but you can't spell anything they want you to do in school. I don't know. Some people like trees. Some people like birds. For me, it was stars.
How long have you been doing street corner astronomy?
I just finished my 27th year. I've been out on the street 2,637 times. It's like being on a Broadway show that has a long run. I had been working for, quote unquote, the man for many, many years, unsuccessfully. Each time I'd start a new job, I'd say, I'm going to stay with it, get benefits, get retirement. But 3 years later, I couldn't stand it anymore. I had to get out of there and got another job. And Friday night, November 13th, 1987, it was a really beautiful evening. The moon was up, and I decided, heck, I'm going to take my telescope on the street and invite people to look at the moon and Jupiter. And as I was walking out the door, I said, I'll take a hat with me and see what happens. That first night, I made $10. And I went back the next night and made $40. And that's how it started. Back in 1997, a local writer wrote about my being a star hustler on the street. One of the questions was, how did you get started in astronomy? And I said, Miss Wicker's class in the eighth grade, she drew the Big Dipper on the blackboard, said, go find it. I didn't know if Miss Wicker was dead or alive, but she saw the article and called me up. And I was one of the eulogizers at her funeral.
How would you like to be remembered?
I don't want to be remembered. Halley's Comet comes back in 2061, and I want to be around. But I can name people who have looked through my telescope and taken up astronomy themselves, bought their own telescopes. Somebody else said they named a boat Saturn after looking at it through my telescope. Makes me feel it's worthwhile what I'm doing, that I'm doing a good thing. And over the years, I've been hoping that somebody would come along and say, I got my PhD in astronomy, having first looked through your telescope, but it hasn't happened yet. I'm hoping it still may.
You are listening to Think on KERA. This is Chris Boyd, and I'm speaking this hour with Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. You just heard Herman Hine and John Hine talking about Uncle Herman's business as a street corner astronomer. What an interesting person who has really just found a way to, like, follow his dreams, despite the fact that there's no lab behind him.
Right.
He just made this thing happen.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of courage. You know, the last three lines in the book are a 93-year-old grandfather talking to his granddaughter about his work. He was supposed to be a dairy farmer, and he left the farm and did something else. And he said, you know, live with courage. And that's something that Herman did and a lot of the people in this book do.
There are people here who have, like, carried on the family tradition and done what generations have done.
Right.
And then there's some mavericks,
yeah,
that just decided that they had to be what they had to be.
Yeah. There are a lot. You know, I think of, well, there's everything as dramatic as an African-American kid from a very small town in North Carolina who ended up becoming an astronaut. Despite unbelievable odds, his brother came in to tell that story. We'll play that tonight. And then ended up dying on the Challenger shuttle. To someone like tomorrow night, I'll be in New York and we'll do a reading with a guy named Murat Kogut and his kid. And Murat Kogut, actually, strangely enough, although it has nothing to do with him doing StoryCorps, is my kid's barber. And he actually doesn't know that I run StoryCorps, so we'll figure that out tomorrow when he's at this reading.
Wow.
But his kid, he's an immigrant from the Ukraine, and his kid knew that the only thing he wanted to do in life was to be a basketball ref. When he was growing up, his parents wanted him to be a doctor or a lawyer. And one day the kid came to his dad and said, okay, how many lawyers are there in the United States? And his dad said, I don't know, 3 million. He said, how many doctors? His dad said, I don't know, 8 million. And he said, how many NBA refs are there? And the dad said, I don't know. And he said, there are 36 and I'm going to be one of them. You know, So, in some way, I actually think everybody, even though they're quiet mavericks, everybody in this book is a maverick one way or another. I think we did a story last week on NPR. Our StoryCorps broadcast on Friday morning was a woman who was a single mom who was raising four kids, and she was putting one of her kids in college, and she was like signing up with the registrar, and out of the corner of her mouth, she said, I wish I could go to college. Mm-hmm. And the registrar heard her and said, well, you can, and I'll help you. And she was working at Dairy Queen. She had four jobs. She was cleaning dentist's office, and then she started going to school. And she didn't she thought she was terrible at science, and she had to take a science elective. And she looked up the different things. She saw anthropology, and she went home and it said the study of, you know, humankind. And she was like, well, that sounds interesting. And the minute she stepped into that anthropology class, she knew that this was what she was going to do for the rest of her life. And she became a forensic anthropologist, rebuilding faces of murder victims and, off of skulls and in museums and, you know, prehistoric skulls and that kind of stuff. She did it for decades and decades and decades, and she found that thing. I mean, one of the lessons of StoryCorps is that that calling, you know, can come early in life. I was lucky. I was really young when I found my calling, or can come, you know, later in life, 60s, 70s, 80s. Someone came up to me last night at a reading in Austin, and he said, so, you know, what happens once you find your calling and then you get old? And then I was like, you just keep going. And he's like, that's right. I've been a professor for 50 years and they're never getting me out of that classroom.
We're speaking this hour with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. His newest book is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town for an event tonight at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art, where he will be playing StoryCorps submissions. You will also be able to see some animations. And there is a special guest, perhaps, planning to be there tonight. Maybe we'll talk about that in a minute. We will come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. His newest book is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town for an Arts and Letters Live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. So as you go around to different parts of the country, how often do you have like a little StoryCorps reunion? Maybe you've never actually met this person before, but they have submitted something that ends up meaning a lot to millions of people.
Well, when I travel around the country on book tour, basically every night someone comes who's in the book.
How amazing is that for you?
It's really fun. And what makes me know that the producers, the people in our production team, who are really, you know, basically what they're doing is taking this, we were just talking about this off air a little bit, they're taking this 40-minute interview and they're condensing it into poetry, you know. And whenever I meet, you know, whether it's Herman Hein last week, the astronomer, like the people who, when I meet them in person, are just as great as they seem on the radio and usually even better, which lets me know that the producers are doing a beautiful and honest job in the way they edit these interviews.
Do you have rules when people sit down to edit? Is there like an ethos that is applied to what you will not change, but what you will remove and what has to stay in, that sort of thing?
Yeah. I mean, the ethos is that we're true to the story of, I mean, we try to be the vehicle through which people can, you know, can tell the essence of their story. So the rule is that we make it as true to the spirit of the people in the interview as possible. I mean, we clean it up. This is now technical, you know, but we take out oohs and ums and we'll pace it correctly. But we always, you know, when you come to StoryCorps, you sign a release at the end of the interview or you don't. If you don't sign the release, you walk away with a copy of the interview. We destroy the fact that you've come to StoryCorps. There's no record of it whatsoever. And I thought that we'd see a compliance rate of, 60 or 70%, because what happens is so intimate in the booths, and it's been 99.99999%. Everybody signs a release. And when we're assigned the release, we have the right to broadcast the stuff, but we always take the material and bring it back to the participants before we broadcast and make sure that they feel that like it's the truth of what they were trying to say. And we also fact check within an inch of our lives every one of these stories. So what you hear on the radio, this 0.04% of what we broadcast, is fact checked to New Yorker magazine standards, because what we're doing is so kind of weird, and you don't make a mistake when you do this kind of stuff, because it's easy for people to kind of criticize this, when you just have regular people kind of telling their truth. So we want to make sure that we're telling a true story and that we're not doing anybody any damage at all.
Does it ever happen that people just honestly remember details incorrectly?
Yes.
And you want to use that? What do you do about that?
Well, that happens in the booth all the time. And in the stories, it's very infrequent that there's anything that doesn't fact check correctly in those 2 minutes of story that we broadcast. So we've done, 660 weeks in a row on Morning Edition, and there's only two that haven't fact checked. And one of them was last week, actually, which is very convenient since I was on the road, but it's very rare. And if there's a fact that's wrong, or someone misremembers something, or there's an age that's wrong, we just cut around it.
Mm-hmm. Some great stories have their origins in great tragedy. Tell us about this young man who left Nigeria to join his father looking for a better life, and had a real struggle in the beginning.
Sure. I think I might play this one tonight because it's – I know that it's – I saw on Twitter – Facebook, I don't understand. Twitter, I'm on once a day, maybe. God, I feel, I sound so old. That's so sad.
Tweets when
yes,
you're on Twitter.
I know. I saw that it's Teacher Appreciation Week. Hmm. So this is a teacher story. If there's any profession in this book that shows up more than any other one, it's teachers are everywhere. And this is Ayodeji Oguniyi, who came to the United States from Nigeria. And lived in Chicago. His father was working as a cab driver, and one night he was robbed and killed. And Ayodeji was headed to medical school, and what happened that night completely changed the course of his life.
11 o'clock that night, the knock came. They told us that my father was found in the alley and he was murdered. I remember yelling no really loud, and my brother was going haywire, and he punched a hole in the wall. And then my mother she started to pull her hair, and she scratched her face. They found the murders in 4 days. They were 18, 19, and 22. I was angry. I was very, very angry. I didn't want to retaliate. I just wanted to just ask them why. What happens to a person? Where do they get lost to become murderers? So, at the time, I was tutoring at an after-school program for some extra money, and these kids came from the same conditions that the people that murdered my father came from. A student came to the after-school program. I was probably around 16 years old. We were doing something where everyone had to read out loud. He stormed out the classroom, and I went out to talk to him. And he just broke down. He said, "It's hard for me to read." There are many people that cry because they're hurt, they've been neglected, but to cry because you couldn't read, that spoke volumes to me. So we got him in some other programs, and he started to read, and it just was like this gift that money can't buy for him. And by me giving that to him, I totally forgot about the pain of the murder, and I wanted to continue to give more of what I had to heal. It just dawned on me, everybody at some point sits in a classroom. That could be the foundation for everything else. So that's when I said that whatever happened to my father is not going to be in vain. I'm going to follow my heart and become a teacher.
This This is Think on KERA. We're speaking with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. His new book that includes essays in written form, just like the one you just heard, is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. He's in town, Dave is, for an Arts and Letters live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. How often do people in interviews ask you the favorite StoryCorps questions?
Well, I'm never in the booth. When people come, so we have facilitators and it's two people who come to the booth together. Before you come to the booth, I mean, just like your job and when I used to make radio documentaries, you know, you want to be prepared. So people will prepare the questions before they come in. And we have something on our website called a question generator. And that has, you know, the 10 most popular questions and then dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of other ones. And everybody prepares before they come in. We usually say don't have the person who's being interviewed know what the questions mm-hmm. are. But, you know, what the facilitators will always say to the participants when they come in is, you know, you want to ask that question you've always wanted to ask very early on because the 40 minutes goes by so incredibly quickly. So the interviews get very intense very quickly. But the big, you know, I think that the most commonly asked questions are those questions which are in the back of the book, you know, big life questions, you know, how do you want to be remembered? You know, what are the most important lessons you've learned in life? I mean, these are the questions that people want to ask and they ask over and over and over again. And as you know, something else about the booth is that the microphone gives you the license to ask questions and to say things, to talk about things you never otherwise get to talk about. And that happens in the booth many times a day, every day, 365 days a year.
Are you better at asking those questions of the people in your life than other people are?
No. No, absolutely not. You know, sometimes I get introduced as like Dave Isay, the world's greatest listener. I'm a terrible listener. I am totally impatient. If I'm doing an interview with mm-hmm. someone, I'm a very good listener. But, you know, people are there. You know, they are there are two lessons that the facilitators tell you about the humanity that they learn after being on the road. And I know we were in Dallas just a couple months ago and meeting, you know, doing interviews with thousands of people. One is that people are basically good. And the other is that you can't really judge someone's internal life by, you know, how they look or what they're wearing. And I guess also by their reputation, you know, because I'm when you're doing interviews, it's a very intense kind of listening. It's almost like there are like laser beams between your eyes and and that's what it's supposed to be. And nobody can do that kind of listening all day. Or maybe some people can, people who work in hospice and do other things. But I'm not skilled or talented enough to do that kind of listening all the time.
It is strange though. You meet those people. My sister-in-law is one of these who have never met a stranger, and they do have that ability to connect
right.
just instantly with people they meet. And it takes
right.
me a much longer time to feel close to people.
Well, I'm you know, I don't know. Are you an introvert?
I'm not sure anymore.
Yeah, well, I am. So I find it so, you know, being around people is that, you know, that kind of means that it kind of makes you tired. And
mm-hmm.
I'm sure for your sister-in-law, it's energizing
yeah.
to be around people. Yeah.
Are there some that you think are too heavy to, you know, play for people during Morning Edition?
I don't think so. I mean, there's some stuff that's not appropriate to play. And, you know, there are a lot of interviews where you have people crying through the interview and it's not, you know, it's just, I mean, I think what we will play stories that have something to teach. You know, I think what a lot of these stories are people, everyday people. They're all everyday people. There's nobody famous at StoryCorps. We had President Obama participate, but he interviewed like an ex-offender, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and that's as close as we get to someone who's famous. But I think it's everyday people living, you know, lives of courage and grace, and kind of showing us shining a light for us about a life well lived, And those are the stories we tell and a lot of them. We have a reputation of making people cry, and most of the stories actually aren't sad. I think what happens in these stories is you're hearing, you know, we're surrounded by so much kind of nonsense, and it's hard to tell what's real and what's an ad, and no one's telling the truth, you know. And with StoryCorps, you're just hearing someone speaking with humility and honesty about a life well lived, and you're kind of walking on holy ground when you hear that. And I think that that's what makes people feel emotional.
It's really sort of miraculous, isn't it, that we can be introduced, you know, in 20 seconds yeah. to someone's situation and then hear them for most of the pieces are what, two and a half, three minutes,
yeah, 3 minutes
on Morning Edition.
Yeah.
And I think people do feel moved to tears. Like that kind of empathy that we sometimes don't give ourselves enough credit for possessing,
right?
I feel like is on display.
Well, I feel like what you know, for me, the power of radio has always been I actually, over the last couple of weeks, have been thinking that there's almost like a neurotransmitter in our brains, and that a really well-recorded interview or, you know, voice, like your brain is telling you that person is with you.
Hmm.
You know, so when you're driving in the car and you've got whoever it is, Ayodeji Ogunyi, talking about his dad, he's sitting in the passenger seat with you, whispering in your ear. And again, I think that an authentic voice, and people can hear when something's nonsense, and they can hear when something's real. You know, we have those detectors. That that it's like an adrenaline shot right to the heart; it goes right into you. You know, and I think and that's one of the reasons why I love radio so much. But I think it's true for print stuff also. It's about authenticity and the purpose with which people have told their story.
I love the story about your wife's obstetrician.
Yes, Dr. Chen.
Tell us about her.
So she's the inspiration for StoryCorps. So I think of her as my OBGYN. Also,
she gave birth to
love
your
her.
Passion.
Yes, I know. She's this amazing person who Chinese immigrant had made the commitment to deliver all the babies that her patients had. She had a practice in New York City, which meant, and she was conscious about this, she worked 365 days a year for 15 years. And I knew a little bit about her. She had told me that that she had done that she had never left the city, never been able to leave the city. She said her only regret was that when her father was dying, she got on a train to go see him and say goodbye, and she got a call that one of her patients was in labor, and she turned around and couldn't say goodbye to her father.
Hmm.
So, but again, she does not, you know, she said, this was my choice, that I knew exactly what I was doing, and I have absolutely no regrets about it. And I went to see her. We went to see her one day before our second kid was born, and I had been lucky enough to be on Colbert's show the night before. And as I was leaving, she said, I wish I had done something important enough with my life to be on Colbert. She had seen me the night before. And I said, Dr. Chen, are you kidding? Like, if you took everyone who'd ever been on Colbert, they couldn't, like, they're not worthy of your pinky, you know. And she ushered me out the door. But that night when we were, that afternoon, I had a meeting with the publisher, and we were trying to figure out what the next book was. And I told that story. And then it was like, boom, it's Callings. And that's what, you know, it's paying tribute to people like Dr. Chen who don't get the love that they deserve.
Dave Isay is founder of StoryCorps. The new book drawn from StoryCorps submissions is called Callings, The Purpose and Passion of Work. Dave and I will sit down tonight at an Arts and Letters Live event at the Dallas Museum of Art. And until then, it's been great to see you, Dave.
Good to see you. Thanks, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.